Okay. Hi, this is Aris. I engineer Curiomancy, and I'm here in a cafe working on putting some of the final edits on our show's pilot. We really appreciate you giving it a listen. Curiomancy is a show about collections, collectors, material culture, and magic. Don Miller's story, the one you're about to hear, is just one of many we've been working on. Like in another piece we're producing, there's this lady named Alma who sold her house to buy millions of dollars worth of paintings. Or in another one, we explore the path a little read from some of Jane Goodall's early work in the Congo makes to a dusty, forgotten warehouse in the Chicago suburbs. Crazy, right? We think these stories are both interesting and important, which is why we want to work with you to get them to as many ears as possible. So yeah, this is definitely a pitch, but it's also a love letter to the power of interesting stories and how badly we want you to help us tell them. Thanks, and enjoy the pilot episode of Curiomancy.
History is strange. There are a lot of ways to understand it, but one of them goes like this. Imagine an angel. Its wings are spread out, and it's looking at the past. And the past isn't like you or I might see it, not a line of events trailing off into darkness, but a huge, chaotic mess. A catastrophe, where the wreckage is piling up to the sky. The angel wants to stay and repair the damage of time, to raise the dead back to life. But there's a wind from heaven blowing, and it pushes him toward the future. He can't close his wings, he can't turn around to see what's behind him, he just watches as the debris builds up. At his face, the chaos of history, at his back, progress, the future.
You know, 244, Jim, I can just tell you, 244 on the north side of this property runs east-west, and 850 south runs north-south to it. So where that intersection is, it's blocked, and then where 850 goes to the next road down, that's blocked.
Do you remember that day?
Yeah, I was coming home on State Road 244, and I looked over on Don's Road, and it was blocked with 15 or 20 vehicles, and I thought, what in the world's going on?
Philosopher Walter Benjamin once wrote, "Perhaps the most deeply hidden motive of the person who collects can be described this way. He takes up the struggle against dispersion." You can almost see that collector scrambling over the wreckage. He picks and pulls at things among the chaos, trying to preserve a tiny semblance of order. All the while, the gargantuan angel looks on in the distance.
It's a developing story we first reported today at noon. Federal agents are at the home because of what's inside. That home on Country Road 850 West, just south of State Road 244. 24-Hour News 8's Kylie Conway is live tonight near the home. And Kylie, you actually got a look at what was inside.
I immediately tried to contact them, and we actually couldn't make any contact with Don or with Sandy.
How many days?
For 3 or 4 days. Don's niece, she just got in the car and drove up there and said, "I'm Don's niece. I'm coming in to see him," flat out.
Mr. Miller may have knowingly and unknowingly collected artifacts, relics, and objects of cultural patrimony in violation of several treaties, federal and state statutes.
In trying to imagine the kinds of people who would want that, what about that makes it okay for them?
Frankly, overwhelmed. I have never seen a collection like this in my entire life, except at some of the largest museums.
The present is fleeting. It turns into the past with a tick of the second hand. Most of us just let it go, but not collectors. They scramble through the chaos of the passing moment to find objects, knickknacks, tchotchkes, keepsakes, and curios that will help us remember what it was like to live in those moments. The angel of history can't rebuild the world for us, but the collectors can. They scurry through the eons, skipping years by the hundreds, thousands, millions, to find objects, evidence, of where we've been. Assembled on shelves and in glass cabinets of wonder, these objects form an intricate and supernatural network of revelations about who we are. It's a kind of hopeful magic, an inverse divination.
Don Miller, his greatest joy in life was to give a tour of his little museum.
Officials say his extensive collection is made up of Native American artifacts and others from across the world. The FBI is now involved because they say some of that stuff needs to be returned to its now rightful owners.
If you're protecting it because it's part of human history and human culture, then it belongs to humanity.
Wait a minute, let me get this straight. Were they under some sort of potential criminal liability? How on earth could the government,
Then there is the collector himself.
And he has been very cooperative at this point. And I think the goal here again is to identify those items, see if they belong in elsewhere, and we're going to work closely with him to make that happen.
In the name of repatriation, they came in and they stripped Don's collection.
The collection that took 80 years to put together will be dismantled piece by piece.
This was a damned raid.
This is Curiomancy. This is the story about what happened to Mr. Don Miller of Waldron, Indiana, one day early in 2014. I've tried to picture that day in my mind ever since I first heard of it. Don would have been about 91 at the time, and he would have been in the habit of getting up before the sun, making a cup of really bad coffee, sitting down at one of his several organs, and belting out a tune that probably echoed through the walls of his country home and over the fields surrounding his house. He might have sat down at his enormous amateur radio console and hailed a friend in his weakening voice. Maybe he read a magazine article or two before breakfast with his wife, Sandy. That's all speculation. I don't know what happened that morning, or even if he was expecting what was about to happen. What I do know is that sometime before the day really got underway, there was a knock at Don Miller's door. A knock that changed the rest of Don's life. A knock that had been planned and strategized for months. A knock predicated on thousands of years of history. A knock that's really hard to explain. But I'm going to give it my best shot.
It's November 18th, 2017. I am going to Moscow, Indiana, and then Crawfordsville, Indiana, to do two important interviews. One with Jack Spaulding, who claims to be a longtime friend of the notorious Mr. Don.
Ever since I was a kid, I've been fascinated with magic. This crude idea that somehow there's more to the world than we can see on the surface. You look for magic in books and movies and other people who are crazy enough to care about that kind of stuff. But you always tell yourself at the back of your mind it's not real. And maybe it's not. But I recently started a journey to double check. Just to make sure.
Questions to ask. I'll do my best to track along with what he says, but honestly, I just want him to tell me about Mr. Miller, because a lot of that is just a blank canvas. What's his story? I haven't necessarily broken the whole collections part to him, but I don't think he'll be too upset when I say, you know, hey, this story is about collections.
So this is also the story of my hunt for some kind of magic. I set up with a picture of what it was in my mind, and in the end, I did find something. Or at least, I started to. And even though it may be cliched to say so, what I found was nothing like what I expected.
Heading into a storm that looks potentially dangerous.
In early April, after the 2014 incident at Don Miller's home, the Indianapolis Star published an article titled, "Artifact Collector is a Man of Mystery." It told the story of a man who had lived a full life of seemingly tall tales and odd fortune. I was fascinated by what I read there, but I didn't give it much thought until I became interested in collectors, collections, and the magic behind material culture. I started reading more about Don at that point, trying to unravel the mystery of who he was and what had happened to him. Many people involved in this story can't or just don't want to talk about who Don Miller is and what happened at his Rush County, Indiana home in 2014, which made me, to be honest, all the more curious to find out why.
Directions. Take I-74 out of Indianapolis, east like you're going to Cincinnati.
244 east towards Milroy.
So I drove 3.5 hours through a rainstorm to a little gray town in the middle of Indiana nowhere called Moscow for answers.
So Moscow's, it looks like a town that's just kind of been left in the past. It's very ramshackle. There has to be under 30 houses. There's a beautiful white green roofed covered bridge right after your town. Moscow itself is sort of nestled in the middle of fields. Feels hidden from the rest of the world. Spalding residents?
Absolutely, Andrew, I presume.
Jack Spalding and I had emailed back and forth for about a month. We finally met for the first time on a rainy pre-winter morning. He had told me that he had some of the answers I was looking for, bits of the puzzle that I was trying to piece together.
Yes, that is my name.
Good morning.
Mr. Spalding, good to finally meet you, sir.
Yeah, come on in.
Thank you so much for being able to get me a little bit earlier than we had originally planned.
Oh, no problem, no problem.
I really appreciate it.
Come on in, have a seat.
Wonderful, thank you so much.
Jack offered me coffee before we sat down in his small, cozy kitchen.
Would you care for some coffee?
You know,
we chatted about the
coffee.
Roads a bit.
Thank you. I noticed you came in from the south.
That is correct, sir.
Yeah.
And then Jack told me that everything that I'd read about his friend Don Miller wasn't true.
It's got a lot of controversy surrounding it, and so it's actually been...
Most of the controversy about Don Miller was contrived.
What do you mean by that?
If it's not clear by now, let me lay it on the table for you. My hunt for magic led me directly to a habit. It's a habit that possesses millions of people throughout time and geography. There's even evidence suggesting that you and I are possessed by it. That habit is collecting. Now, what you have to understand about collecting and collectors is that they're often surrounded by a mist of contrivances, what Jack Spalding called the
unreal and imaginary.
So to start with, it might be helpful for you to understand the first of many rules of what I'm going to call curiomancy. Here it is.
Rule number one. Whether by coincidence, providence, or some other force, collectors lead unordinary and often unbelievable lives. Lives where it's hard to tell what is real and what is not.
This is especially the case in the story of Mr. Miller. There are two very distinct sides to who he is, and whether what he did was the work of a criminal, or a legend, or both. As Jack Spalding put it,
well, I think it was smoke and mirrors.
So before we get into smoke and mirrors, let's talk about bombs. One bomb in particular.
Part one, the bomb.
How'd you guys meet? You know,
we met through the Christian church.
Here's what's important to know about Jack Spalding.
As a young man, as I still do, I attend church.
And?
I'm a construction material salesman.
Okay.
I work for Trinity Industries.
Also?
I'm a writer myself. I've written professionally since 1986. Outdoor writer. Hunting and fishing, yeah.
And most importantly?
Don Miller was absolutely my best friend.
And as best friends do, Don and Jack talked a lot, traveled the world together, played practical jokes on each other, and from fragments of Jack's memories and scattered small-town newspaper profiles emerges this picture of a man, Don Miller, who was nothing less than remarkable. For instance, maybe we should start with the fact that
Don was very heavily involved in the development of the atomic bomb.
Yeah, worked in the Manhattan Project, didn't he?
Yeah, and he worked directly for Oppenheimer.
Who's Oppenheimer?
Dr. J. Robert Oppenheimer, a physicist.
He was in charge of the lab in Los Alamos, New Mexico, that developed the atomic bomb, which made him one of the most influential physicists of the 20th century. Among other things, he's famous for quoting Vishnu in the Bhagavad Gita when he takes on his multi-armed form and says,
"Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds." I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
And in this case, we all included Don Miller.
Don, through luck and I guess providence, he was chosen to work directly on the Manhattan Project.
According to Spalding and an article by reporter Elizabeth Gist of the Rushville Republican, a Rush County newspaper, Don made a quick and almost extraordinary rise from Indiana farm boy to A-bomb engineer. So here's the weird set of events that draw the line between Milroy, Indiana, the little town where Don grew up, to an explosion in the Los Alamos desert, and then beyond. So Don graduates from Milroy High School in 1941, and in the middle of his freshman year at Tri-State College in Angola, where he's studying electrical engineering, World War II starts.
A state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
According to Miller, he joins the reserves and wards off the army for 6 more months so he can keep studying. But eventually he ends up on a train that takes him to begin Signal Corps training, but he gets lost. The army actually loses him in Biloxi, Mississippi, according to Don. And so he doesn't go into the Signal Corps after all because he's already completed basic training with the Air Corps. But one day he sees a sign on his captain's door that reads, "Join the ASTP and go back to college." And he asks his captain, "Well, what's the ASTP? And his captain doesn't know, so he does some digging. He realizes it stands for Army Specialized Training Program, which is accepting thousands of students back into college. Don Miller loves to learn, which Jack attested to.
Don was a ravenous reader. He ate up publications and books.
And he doesn't think twice about an opportunity to go back to college and finish his studies. So he goes to Ohio State for a year, graduates at the top of his class, takes an exam with the Army, and gets picked through a rather weird process.
There were like 15 or 16 individuals, and they were going to select 6 or 8 from it. Well, Don says, well, they went through, and I was one of them they picked. He said the reason they picked me was because of my name. He said all the other guys that they didn't pick had Jewish names, and they didn't want to have anybody with Jewish lineage on the project for fear these individuals might have family back in country being held by the Axis powers. Mm-hmm. And to where, you know, they could be blackmailed or coerced, you know, over the safety of family members. And he said, yeah, I said, my name, Don Miller. He said, there's nothing Jewish about that.
In the article, Gist reports that Miller remembered his fellow top-of-the-class ASTP members being taken away and never coming back. Nobody knew for what, but then Don's name was called.
Don Miller.
And he goes on another train ride. This time, to Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
In the control room of the big reactor at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, an operator watches the instruments as men prepare to load it with slugs of uranium.
But then they kick him out, and he gets back on the train again, and this time he's going to the right place. He's going to Los Alamos, New Mexico. And we all know that what happens in Los Alamos stays in Los Alamos. Well, we know that, and Don knew it, but he didn't know why. In the article, Don said that he was interviewed by a Nobel Prize winner at Los Alamos. We can only assume that this must have been Louis Walter Alvarez, a renowned physicist and inventor of the time. And he starts working on
spark plugs. They had to find a series of spark plugs that all would spark exactly within 0.2 of a second. That explosion compressed the steel ball and the uranium, and then the release was the atomic event.
But Don doesn't know anything about this until one day when he says he went to his boss and asked him what they were doing here. His boss didn't say anything, but he asked Miller if he'd studied physics, and when Miller said yes, he pointed to a chapter in one of the textbooks that Don had studied during college, a chapter that described the work of a man named Enrico Fermi and his work on nuclear fission. He connected the dots until one day he realized he was helping to make the nuclear bomb.
Part of Don's museum was a half round, and all it was a solid steel ball that was hollow in the inside and cut in two. And he had one of those, but it was one of the originals that were designed to be incorporated into the atomic bomb.
That museum, by the way, may be the only reason that we know anything about Don today, but we'll talk about that later. For now, all you need to know is this. Don kept memorabilia from his days at the Manhattan Project, along with distinct memories of what happened during that time in his life, all of which he talked about openly with anybody who asked for years to come. But back to the story. So Miller's working in Los Alamos, and it's 1945, and the war is not going well for America. And he's sitting at a hotel bar in Santa Fe, and he overhears some military personnel talking. One of them sees Miller and his Los Alamos buddies, and the guy says something to his friend that freaks Miller out, something along the lines of, "I hear they're going to test that gadget next month." Remember, at this point, very few people know much about what they're making out there in the desert of New Mexico. Don ran to Oppenheimer's office. Don called him Opie in the interview with the Republican and asked him if it was true that they were indeed going to test the bomb. Oppenheimer apparently turned white in response, but Don didn't leave the scientist's office before he begged to be on the testing team. He didn't immediately get a response, but a week later, Oppenheimer calls Miller up to tell him that he would be seeing the first nuclear explosion in recorded history, an event codenamed Trinity. By the way, I'm still trying to get over the fact that Don allegedly knew Oppenheimer on a nickname basis. 1945, July 16th. Just reports Miller's recollections of that day. It started to rain in the wee hours of the morning. He said, quote, "Some of the guys were saying that it was a sign that God didn't want us to do this. People were taking bets as to whether or not the atmosphere would explode when we dropped the thing. It was a day of reckoning for everyone."
They had built a bunker with glass slots for everybody to go down and watch the bomb go off and to be protected. Well, Don and a close friend of his, when Don gave the signal, they wanted to run down in the bunker and see what was going on. Well, they get down in the bunker and all the places are taken up by the brass and the big shots. They've got nowhere to look. So they run outside and they get up on top of the parapet wall and kind of shield their eyes, and the bomb goes off.
That day was the end of the beginning for Don Miller. It was his first gigantic step in becoming larger than life.
He went to Oppenheimer after the end of the war and told Oppenheimer, he said, "I'd like to get out of the army, go home and get married." And Oppenheimer said, "Well, Don," he said, "how about this? How about you're out of the army, you got 2 weeks to go home and get married, then you come back and go to work for me." And Don says, "Okay, how do I go about getting out of the army?" Oppenheimer says, "You just did. I just said you're out of the army. You're out of the army.
It's hard to trace the origins of Don Miller's collection. Maybe it started when he was a boy, scrounging up arrowheads from the turned-up ground of Indiana cornfields, and maybe it started when he took a half-round from the Army scrap pile at Los Alamos. Maybe it started the moment that he was born, but Don's experience at the Manhattan Project opened the doors for the man the world would come to remember him as, the collector. Which brings us to
rule number two. Most of us are content to let the world pass by. A collector hunts the world down and keeps it.
So Don went home, came back. Oppenheimer salaried him at $12,000 a year.
This would have been somewhere around $166,000 in today's money.
Yeah, and this is in like a 1945. Most guys were out here scrapping and working for, you know, $35, $40 a week.
Don's hunt for knowledge always brought him back to the world of academics. He got his PhD from Purdue, finally, and continued to work for Oppenheimer for some time. But at this point, there's this meeting of two very important things in Don's life. Opportunity and the thrill of the hunt.
Part 2, Thrill of the Hunt.
I swear, George Lucas missed it. He made up Indiana Jones. Don Miller was the real Indiana Jones.
Wait, stop. Okay, so this is where things take a turn for the questionably legal.
You know, we all think about Indiana Jones because it's, you know, it's an exciting movie. It's a fun movie we all watched when we were kids. But Indiana Jones was, you know, he claimed to be an archaeologist in the film. If you ask any archaeologist about Indiana Jones, he is a terrible archaeologist.
Would you mind stating your name and occupation just for the record?
My name is Derek Fincham. I'm a law professor at South Texas College of Law in Houston, and I write in cultural heritage law and arts and antiquities issues.
So as things start to get muddy, let's keep Dr. Fincham in the wings while we take a journey to the center of the earth.
Don Miller's Rush County basement holds perhaps more artifacts than a museum.
Don Miller, his greatest joy in life was to give a tour of his little museum.
Could you actually give me a tour? Because one of my biggest regrets in life at this point is that I never got to see that museum.
I don't know as I can set that up, but I'll talk.
No, what? It still exists.
Yeah, it's in his basement at the house there, what's left of it.
Don Miller's basement, the beating heart of this whole mess. How do I put this? So imagine this basement as like an explosion that happens in reverse over a long period of time, where all this stuff from everywhere landed in Don Miller's basement. And then, the big picture is a little fuzzy. Multiple sources say that Don Miller traveled the world after his work with Oppenheimer. That's not really in question. Jack Spaulding says that Miller had more individual country stamps in his passport than there are countries in the world today. And there are several snippets of stories from the people who Don knew confirming his extensive travels. To get a picture of how extensive they were, here are some numbers. 11,000 miles in 56 days. So that's the distance and the time that it took Don and his wife to travel around the perimeter of Australia. Spaulding and a profile of Miller from the Indianapolis Star confirmed this.
He said, yeah, I said, soon I flew it twice.
Twice is the number of times Don Miller told Jack that he flew the Concorde to Europe.
I said, wow.
Six is the number of weeks Miller got off as a senior consultant at the Naval Avionics Center in Indianapolis, time he used to go artifact hunting. This according to a colleague who worked with him during the 70s and the 80s.
He had three meteorites. And then
Don get three meteorites.
Well,
three meteorites.
Three is the number of meteorites Don Miller had in his collection. And one. One is the number of devices engineered by Don and shipped directly into space. We think that our world is small because someone from across the globe is a video call away. Don knew that long before cell phones were invented. So there's a story about Don engineering and then helping send a radio television device to cosmonauts on the MIR space station in a crate full of fruits and vegetables. I can't confirm the fruits and vegetables part, but the part where he sends the radio wave image transfer device called an SSTV to the space station, that's true. There's a picture from December 12, 1998 of a cosmonaut named Gennady Padalka suspended in zero gravity holding up Don's device. Don himself received the transmission at his home in Indiana.
Don could get things done, but Don was not a malicious person. He wasn't a person to do anything wrong.
Not everyone believes that. That basement? It was full of things. Nobody who visited forgot it. dinosaur eggs, a dugout canoe from the Amazon, a 60-foot long, 4-foot wide anaconda snakeskin, Civil War memorabilia, gear from both World Wars, an alleged fragment of the bunker where Hitler died, Ming Dynasty jade, shrunken heads, an 1873 Winchester carbine, dozens of buffalo hammers, thousands of arrowheads, Anasazi pot shards, and...
the full skeleton is what blew my mind.
Bones.
He was probably somebody, when he started collecting, everybody thought, not everybody, but many people thought that that was a perfectly acceptable thing to do. He's interested in the past. It's a relatively innocuous hobby or a fun hobby or even one that is a really good thing to do to preserve and protect this material. Well, as we kind of learn more things about where this stuff comes from, we start to realize that people like Mr. Miller and other collectors actually are doing a lot of harm.
At the beginning of my investigation into Don's life, I sent an email to a professor at Indiana University, Dr. Larry Zimmerman, professor of anthropology and museum studies and public scholar of Native American representation. Here he is on the day of the press conference.
I'm frankly overwhelmed. I have never seen a collection like this in my entire life except at some of the largest museums.
As large as the scope of Zimmerman's work is, this statement that he gave is shocking. He was impressed by Don's museum. It must have been something more than out of the ordinary. Zimmerman told me that he was under a non-disclosure agreement with the FBI and could not speak directly about the case, but he encouraged me to look into, quote, general ethical and legal issues with collecting, looting, or trafficking human remains and grave goods, unquote. All it takes is a quick Google search to realize that the world of looting, trafficking, stolen and traded grave goods, and all the legal and cultural matters that surround them is far deeper than a basement in Waldron, Indiana, which in turn makes that basement in Waldron, Indiana, far more than just a basement. Depending on the way you look at things, Don Miller may have been a criminal who committed a Class 6 felony, and his basement may have been one of the most public troves of cultural crime the state of Indiana has ever seen.
Looting. Illegally taking artifacts or cultural heritage material from its archaeological context.
There's a war going on to protect history. You can take your pick of sides. There are the indigenous people, the hobby archaeologists, the anthropologists, the black market dealers, the collectors, the federal government, and it's populated with stuff right out of a fantasy novel. Thieves and paid looters, multinational organizations and solo crime fighters, double agents and secret task forces named after ancient Greek myths, rich museums and even richer businessmen, religious wars and status symbols, secret backroom meetings, mysterious deaths, and things that vanish in the night. I'm not being dramatic. All that happened, pardon me, is still happening. And it's not going to end anytime soon. This invisible war of objects and who owns them marches on. And it's a very, very complicated war. So let me hit a few highlights of how that war works. And then we'll go back to the basement. Let's start with UNESCO.
The Charter of UNESCO declares, since wars begin in the minds of men, it is in the minds of men that the defenses of peace must be constructed.
UNESCO, or the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, starts as a group of good people, people like Albert Einstein and Marie Curie, who wanted to reconstruct education systems after the Second World War is over. And even though countries come and go from UNESCO, something that you should keep in mind for later, the mission to educate remains stable over the years. And in 1970, they formed this treaty, which still exists today, and it's called the Convention on the Means of Prohibiting and Preventing the Illicit Import, Export, and Transfer of Ownership of Cultural Property. I'm assuming that most of the discussion time around this convention was just spent saying its name. Anyway, there's this big discussion about the problem of, you guessed it, looting. At least, looting was a big part of it. You see, in the 1970s, along with your run-of-the-mill illegal drugs and weapons dealing, there was also a thriving black market for cultural antiquities. At that time in history, new countries were gaining independence and recognition, and among the things that they wanted as a part of their new statehood was their stuff back. They had no real legal protection from looters or big museums or really anybody who just wanted to waltz in, find something that they thought would look nice on a shelf, and take it. So So at a meeting in April of 1970, 61 countries approved these worldwide standards on how countries should treat, well, the illicit import, export, and transfer of ownership and of cultural property. And all the countries outlawed looting, and everybody lived happily ever after. Right? Not right. And that leads us to a very interesting weakness in this convention, one that brings Don Miller back into the picture, and that is the question of retroactivity. Retroactivity. Don't get me started. This is the chicken or the egg conundrum of the cultural heritage world. So retroactivity refers to the problem of, if you took it before we made rules about why you're not allowed to take it, whose is it? And there's the rub. So, quick recap time with Dr. Fincham.
The laws are complex, the laws are complicated, but they basically boil down to a simple idea, which is that if one nation says, this is our cultural heritage, you cannot remove it without permission, the United States is going to, in most cases, recognize that right of another nation to do that and will enforce those ownership declarations.
And by the way, if you've decided to join Team Collector at this point in understanding cultural heritage wars, I've got bad news for you.
For many years, there were a number of collectors who said that that's not what should happen. They had a policy disagreement about that. Well, you can disagree about what a law is, but if a law has been passed and if it's been enforced, what you think about that law is irrelevant. And so you need to abide by the law. And it was a slow change that many collectors are still learning lessons from. And so I think, you know, you started the conversation with wondering, well, what should a collector do? What should they know about these laws? At this point, I don't think you can collect. Nations of origin don't think their past should be for sale.
Peace must therefore be founded, if it is not to fail, on the intellectual and moral solidarity of mankind.
The state of Indiana, not inaccurately self-titled The Crossroads of America, is a fertile archaeological jungle. For instance, several years back, a local headline jumped out at me. Quote, prehistoric remains reburied. Quarry project expected to go on. A quarry crew happened upon what the news termed a mummy and ancient.
A mummified body. The Lake County Sheriff says a mummy could be up to 2,000 years old, and it's possible the site could be an old Native American burial ground.
Work on the proposed quarry. So the body ended up being neither mummified nor prehistoric, but the quarry crew had to change its plans after the remains were respectfully reburied. This happened 45 minutes from where I grew up. Even in the otherwise boring agrarian Midwest, there are rivers of history flowing. If you think about the world before this one, the world before the America that we know, it was fraught with people and cities and creatures and treasures and legends. You can almost feel that river bubbling up to get to the surface. And sometimes, if you dig, you wade right into the current. But, by the way, whatever you do, do not dig.
Like in Indiana, it's legal to collect artifacts that are visible on the surface.
That's the statue?
Yes, in whole or in part. If you're walking along the ground and you see an artifact on the surface that's visible in whole or in part, you can collect it. You cannot dig for them.
That's Dr. Mark Schur.
I'm a professor of anthropology at the University of Notre Dame.
And we're going to need his wisdom to unravel some tough questions in just a minute. But let me draw a line between all that stuff about UNESCO and why it's illegal to put a shovel in the ground in Indiana with the intentions of finding artifacts. I keep throwing this word cultural heritage around, so let me define it. According to UNESCO, and I'm paraphrasing here,
cultural heritage, noun, movable, immovable, and underwater objects, including but not limited to paintings, sculptures, coins, manuscripts, monuments, shipwrecks, underwater ruins, oral traditions, and rituals.
You know what that makes the kid down the street with the sock drawer arrowhead collection, right? Yeah, he's a budding cultural heritage expert. Hopefully. That awkwardly named 1970 convention triggered a shift in American history. It's as though UNESCO had hit like an ethical funny bone in the American legislative body, because in the span of a little over a decade, we went from not caring if people plundered Native American graves to making it a federal offense, punishable by a hell of a long time in prison. Which brings us to 1971, and a woman named Maria Pearson. In 1971, a construction crew working on Highway 34 in southwest Iowa dig up the bodies of 28 people out of a gravesite from the 1800s. 26 of them are white, 2 of them are Native American. So the white people get reburied in a local cemetery, and a woman and her baby end up shipped off to the University of Iowa for study. Unfortunately, this is nothing new. Treating Native American remains like objects instead of, well, remains, is a long-standing practice. But then Maria Pearson, whose real name is Running Moccasins, comes along and she changes everything. When Pearson found out about the mother and child who had been shipped off in a box, she was furious. And why not? Anyway, Pearson dresses up in full tribal regalia and she goes straight to the then governor of Iowa, Robert Ray's office, where some reports say he was trying to hide from her, and starts the ball rolling towards legislation that will protect Native American ancestors and give them peaceful passage and livelihood in the afterlife. It takes almost 2 decades, but the mother and the baby and millions of other ancestors finally get their justice when, in 1990, a new law was signed into existence by George H. Bush on a sunny day in November. It's called the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA.
NAGPRA is a human rights statute.
It is a process. It's a tool.
Level playing field and bring the ancestors back home.
And it draws a line in the sand. Hundreds of thousands of bodies too late. According to one estimate, there are between 300,000 and 2.5 million Native American bodies currently in the possession of U.S. museums, federal agencies, curio shops, and private collections. Put that in perspective. Imagine a 100-year-old movement to raid cemeteries as a weekend hobby or for scientific interest. Imagine your relative's remains being pulled from the ground without anyone's permission, placed in a cardboard box, and shipped to a lab or a glass case in someone's basement. NAGPRA and the individual state looting laws that came before and after it may protect the tatters of buried Native American culture today, but it can't change the ethical crimes of the past.
Don was an absolute genius when it come to artifacts, Native artifacts. He started collecting when he was like 6 or 7 years old.
No.
Oh, yeah. He started collecting as soon as he was able to get out and walk across the plowed ground and find arrowheads on the farmland where he grew up. Early on, Don said that I had 2 loves of my life. He said, archaeology and engineering. And I wanted to be an archaeologist, but I couldn't figure out how to make a living at it. But I knew how to make a living being an engineer. So I made up my mind I would be an engineer for my work and I'd be an archaeologist for me. Yeah.
Oh, Don, if only you knew what that commitment would mean for you down the road.
Part 3, an archaeologist for me.
People collect all sorts of things.
People collect all kinds of stuff, right?
You know, you can collect records, you can collect, you know, mundane things, matchbooks, baseball cards.
Bottle caps, you name it.
Anything. When you talk about a collector of antiquities and ancient art, it's a segment of the population usually who's got means. I mean, it's an expensive hobby. It's an expensive thing to do. And I think people either don't realize or choose not to realize what the laws are and what kind of trouble they might be getting themselves into.
One thing I have heard from stuff, and this was real common, Mr. Miller might have said something like this, like a lot of people that do this feel like this, they'll claim, and I don't know if this is just a rationale, right? That's how it reads to me, is that the things are buried in the ground, they're going to decay, nobody cares about them, I'm at least saving them and protecting them. That's a rationale that I've sometimes heard.
What is your response to that?
I don't think that's a fair rationale. I think it's just a rationalization for behavior that's not legal. And it's not ethical.
And in a lot of instances, Don was able to bring back items that would have wound up rotting on a jungle floor someplace or or lost in a dusty antiquity shop. He got most of his items trading Marlboro cigarettes. Marlboro cigarettes for Don was the universal monetary exchange. Don was not the kind of guy to get receipts for stuff.
Rule number 3, there's no such thing as finders keepers.
Don Miller lived an extraordinary life, but he wasn't one to brag. Jack says that some days he'd walk up to Miller's porch and start chatting, but he'd have to ask about what Don had been up to. Only then would the adventure stories come pouring out. He may have been famous in his little community, but he had no intention of becoming a national fixation for a day. Little did he know, but with every object that he brought back to his home over the years, Don wasn't just building a museum. He was building a moment in history.
Well, look at all the antennas. Does that not surprise you?
April 1st, 2014.
What's the little sign on top say? Something house? Yellow house, I guess, yeah. Something like that's what it says. That's a secret code word, I guess. Yeah, yellow house. That's a secret code word, Jeff.
Suddenly, everyone wanted to know who Don Miller was.
It's a developing story we first reported today at noon. Federal agents are at the home because of what's inside. That home on Country Road 850 West, just south of State Road 244. 24-Hour News 8's Kylie Conway is live tonight near the home. And Kylie, you actually got a look at what was inside.
Absolutely. We actually met a woman who's taken a tour through Don Miller's home a couple years ago, and she took pictures. She was able to send us a few of those photographs just minutes ago. You're going to be able to see them here coming up, but we want to tell you where we are and why we are where we are.
Do you remember that day?
Yeah, I was coming home on State Road 244, and I looked over on Don's road, and it was blocked with this huge camper office complex and 15 or 20 vehicles. And I thought, what in the world's going on?
There simply isn't room near Miller's house for us to park our truck because the FBI has taken over.
It was blocked. The public could not access that road. Matter of fact, the FBI even closed that road for the U.S. Postal Service.
So here we are, but what we found out today is pretty amazing.
I was highly concerned about Don and his second wife, Sandy.
Is that the first thing you thought about?
Oh, yeah. It didn't even register with me that this was some kind of a huge raid. I immediately tried to contact them, and we actually couldn't make any contact with Don or with Sandy for 3 or 4 days.
In a single morning, Don Miller goes from a local legend to a national mystery. The FBI, with a complete team of over 100 agents and experts, built a small encampment around the Miller house. Tents, RV-sized command centers, trailers, trucks, and crates. They were there to take one of the last tours of his basement museum Don would ever give.
Officials say his extensive collection is made up of Native American artifacts and others from across the world. The FBI is now involved because they say some of that stuff needs to be returned to its now rightful owners.
Mr. Miller may have knowingly and unknowingly collected artifacts, relics, and objects of cultural patrimony in violation of several treaties, federal and state statutes.
For the second day, the FBI is in Rush County combing through Miller's possessions. In a brief conversation with CBS, Miller said he invited agents in and says everything he has does belong to him, and they were all collected during his travels to some 200 countries.
He is being cooperative, and so far, everything's going well.
Andy Essex's company did some work in Miller's home a few years ago.
My husband called and said, Andy, Don Miller, he was, the FBI's there. And I'm like, why, what? Leave that old man alone. He's done so much for people.
Why now? Why did the FBI decide to converge on this house in the past 24 hours? The truth to that is we're not 100% sure why. We do know, though, that this investigation, Scott, has been going on for about 3 months or more.
Why is a good question. It's the one most people who were close to Don are still asking.
As far as I know, and I ask about it, and it was never confirmed, I do not believe that there ever was a search warrant filed in federal court for this atrocity that occurred with Don Miller. I may be wrong on that, but I was told a couple of times that people had looked and checked the document records and checked online and could not find any filing of a search warrant by the federal government.
Neither could I. In fact, there's no public legal record involving Don's collection. Looking into the why is like staring into a bottomless well. Trying to figure out why is like jumping into it. But let's do that.
Part 4. A collection in limbo.
Imagine that if I stayed, I probably could get more stories out of you, but we'll save it for some other time.
Yeah, watch your head there.
Very good, yeah. All right. I'll see you. Have a good day, sir. Thank you so much again.
After I left Jack Spaulding's house in the ghostly little town of Moscow, I felt certain there was something off about this whole situation. Various newspaper reports said various things about why the FBI art crime team showed up that day, but two reports emphasized the confusion surrounding the Miller case. One article from the Shelbyville News, the main newspaper in the county where Don lives, says that FBI spokesman Drew Northern said, and here I'm quoting from the article, quote, Miller had contacted the FBI about returning the items, unquote. And then it goes on to say a little bit later that Northern couldn't elaborate on why Miller was looking to repatriate the artifacts now. Then there was another article, this one from CBS News, and it says that, once again, I quote, he, Don, said he absolutely had rightful ownership of the artifacts and that he was cooperating with the FBI's search, unquote. These two statements don't make any sense when you set them side by side. The implication that Don both invited the FBI to his home while simultaneously declaring that he quote-unquote absolutely had the rightful ownership of his collection seems absurd. That's two different Dons on the same day. I asked Jack about how Don responded to the incident.
Don was still very unassuming. I asked him, I said, you okay? Yeah, I'm all right. And I said, did they go through your stuff? He said, oh yeah. He said, they went through my stuff. He asked a lot of questions. He said, I tried to answer as much of it as I could. He said, but some of this stuff, he says, I've had so long that I really couldn't tell him where I got it.
And that brings me back to other questions. Were the laws working retroactively to permit this search and seizure? What was the strategy for getting items in Don's collection back to their rightful owners, a process known as repatriation? And why was it supposed to take over 30 years? And then there's this ultimate question, this broad and looming mystery in this case. Is the system built to protect and preserve artifacts really working? Was Don Miller not just a collector, but a looter by proxy and a criminal? Or did the system take advantage of him? It was time to make some phone calls, pay some more visits, and find out. Knowing little to nothing about cultural heritage law forced me to talk with a wide range of individuals. Everyone directly connected to the investigation was reticent to speak with me, so I reached out to professors and legal experts and museum directors and tribal archivists and journalists and others. I had questions about Don and what had happened to him, but I had questions about bigger issues as well, telltale signs that Don's story was caught in the middle of something bigger and more important. Remember I said not to forget that countries come and go from UNESCO? Well, as a matter of sheer coincidence, the U.S. actually announced its withdrawal from UNESCO just as I began my investigation of Don's life and collection.
The U.S. announced it will withdraw from the United Nations Scientific and Cultural Organization, accusing the body of anti-Israel bias.
The U.N.'s Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization.
Another reason it says the U.S. is quitting at the end of 2018.
Called funding from UNESCO much more recently. So why now? And also, does it matter if the U.S. presents?
Well, of course it does. I mean, at one point it used to be something like one-fifth of the UNESCO budget, like the United Nations.
Then, nearly 2 months after that, President Trump announced that the Bears Ears National Monument, with over 100,000 Native American sites on it, would be shrunk from 1.35 million acres to only 220,000. This directly in opposition to principles in the Antiquities Act, a law passed in 1906 to protect natural resources directly and cultural history by proxy.
In the first 100 days, we've taken historic action to eliminate wasteful regulations. They're being eliminated like nobody's ever seen before. There's never been anything like it. The previous administration used a 100-year-old law known as the Antiquities Act to unilaterally put millions of acres of land and water under strict federal control. Have you heard about that?
The deeper I went into Don Miller's basement, the more I found out that these national and global shifts were vitally important to understanding what happened in Waldron on April 1st of 2014. Dr. Fincham helped me begin to understand why.
There was a law that was passed that said the United States basically couldn't belong to any international organization that recognized Palestine. So it goes to the Middle East dispute and the Arab-Israeli conflict. UNESCO took some actions that triggered that law, and so the United States has withdrawn from UNESCO. And I think it's unfortunate because, you know, UNESCO was started by people who saw what happened during World War II and said, you know, maybe we don't need to have so much disagreement and acrimony.
And he went on to point out that there are things that connect us. Things like, well, things.
Beautiful objects.
And culture.
Thinking about the human experience. That's the thing that UNESCO does, I think, that is really great. And some of these political disputes get in the way of what we should really be thinking about with culture, which is how do you live a better, more fulfilling life? How do you get along with people better? How are you happier?
So what do international divides over beautiful objects and culture have to do with one man's collection? A lot. Remember, Don had reportedly been to 200 countries. Reports suggested his collection had amassed items from not only the U.S., but from China, Haiti, Australia, Russia, Papua New Guinea, Italy, New Zealand, Puerto Rico, Greece, Peru, and Canada, to name a few. Public information on precisely what Don may have had is unclear, but if Don had acquired objects
in violation of several treaties, federal and state statutes,
specifically international ones, he automatically becomes a risk. Especially if the federal government knows that he has this stuff and does nothing about it. It's hard to say exactly if Mr. Miller came by his international artifacts illegally, but what's interesting is the possibility that the people he got them from may have. Those, by the way, are the FBI's two words, not mine.
So from that standpoint, was there a crime that had been committed or was being committed? Did he commit a crime in the purchasing of them, or was he allegedly committing a crime by just possessing.
This is Scott Barnhart,
attorney at Pepper Barnhart LLP,
an Indianapolis-based law firm. Scott practices in law surrounding civil rights, civil litigation, and criminal law, and I called him because I wanted to know more about Indiana's policy on criminal forfeiture, specifically retroactive law.
I've dealt with that quite a bit, actually. It implicates the ex post facto clause of the Constitution, right?
Ex post facto translation. So it literally means after the fact, and it refers to, and here I quote a law.com definition, laws adopted after an act is committed, making it illegal, although it was legal when done, or increasing the penalty for a crime after it is committed. Such laws are specifically prohibited by the U.S. Constitution, Article 1, Section 9. Basically, you can't require someone to follow a law that was created after they were sentenced. So what does that mean for Don?
So for him, if he's been collecting all this stuff, or had been collecting all this stuff for years and years and years, that before all the regulations occurred, then what does that mean?
This is when one of the first clues fell into place for me. Why did federal agents tell the media in 2014 that it would take up to 30 years to complete the investigation?
The problem with federal investigations is you don't have enough information to be able to determine, you know, kind of what's going on.
Combine ex post facto laws with the fact that
Don was not the kind of guy to get receipts for stuff.
And you have a mess on your hands. An explosion. And your job is to collect every minute speck of evidence and turn it into some sort of cohesive picture.
They say some of that stuff needs to be returned to its now rightful owners.
Was the FBI acting within the bounds of the laws that dealt with evidence in an ex post facto manner? Even without having the details of this case, it seems impossible to know for sure until you knew the provenance of every single collected item, that is, where each one came from and how it was acquired. And guess what? You cannot put a limit on the amount of time that it would take to know that for sure. Probably more than just 30 years. So for an indefinite amount of time, the Miller Collection will be, as one Indianapolis Star writer put it, a collection in limbo.
I mean, I'd be curious to know what happened with the artifacts. Where did they get? Were they destroyed? Were they, was there an agreement where he signed them over to a museum?
There's no way to know for sure. The FBI told reporters that they could not reveal where the items were being housed. But that's beside the point for now. The point is how and why they legally got there. Meanwhile, the U.S. government is pulling out of UNESCO and making what amounts to a top-down gesture of politically motivated disinterest in cultural heritage. So, let's say Miller's case is about honoring national and international relationships through an effort to preserve culture and repatriate artifacts. Then, what's the point of this investigation? That's a sweeping generality, but here's the point. Cultural laws are difficult to navigate. The most powerful people in the American government don't really seem to care about them anyway, and Don Miller ended up breaking them, thereby losing 80 years worth of stuff that many would argue belong to him.
Most of those laws weren't written when Don accumulated this stuff. So he was grandfathered in his ownership. But, you know, you got the FBI saying, okay, let's see your receipt.
You want a good example of why some people like Jack bristle at the FBI's action in the Miller case? When I first started looking into what happened that day in Waldron, someone told me to read an LA Times piece by reporter Joe Mazingo about a federal investigation called Operation Cerberus Action that targeted several collectors in the Four Corners region of Utah. At first, I brushed the story aside as coincidentally similar, but then a sentence in an academic journal changed my entire concept of the Miller case, and I realized in the space of about a minute that this story wasn't about what happened to Don Miller. It was about what happened to the FBI. Next on Curiomancy, the rest of Don Miller's story.
It's a very serious case. We think it's a part of our responsibility to protect the resources of the tribal land, so it's something that we feel very strongly about.
You know if Dr. Red knew his daughter was under investigation when he committed suicide?
Not something I want to comment on.
I wish I knew. What makes it okay? Is it because it's not your people?
Maybe if we can figure that out, we can get people to stop breaking into other people's graves.
Bingo.
It really does sound from everything about this case as if they believed that they could sweep a large number of artifacts into a net without having to show probable cause one by one that they were out of compliance.
It also depends on these foreign nations and what they're doing to protect their heritage and how aggressive they're going to be to make sure that their patrimony walls aren't broken, to make sure that their artifacts aren't just scattered around the world.
And then the truly scary room is this one.
Okay. It's so outrageous that if you didn't actually know Don Miller, you wouldn't believe it.
Okay. Curiomancy is created and produced by Andrew Jones. Sound design and engineering by Reese Fairling Hood. Music by Vince Schiller. Extra narration vocal by me, Flannery Lindner. Thanks to Grace Crane and Eric Johnson for research help, and Indiana University, the University of Notre Dame, and Kaffer Barnhart, LLP for their expertise.
Thanks to Jack Spaulding, Dr. April Sievert, Dr. Mark Schur, Dr. Derek Fincham, Leila Aminadullah and Aminadullah and Associates, LLP, Walter Olson, the Pokagon Band of the Potawatomi, and the Indiana Archaeological Society. If you want to know more about the Curiomancy Project, visit curiomancy.com. Goodbye.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.